This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Well, if you are a working serf in this country, you've got, about 12 days, almost 2 weeks to make your final tax payment. You are probably in the process now of filing your tax returns, and probably many of you, I know if you live here in California, well, you're probably going through sticker shock when your accountant says, guess what? Remember that tax bill passed in November? Well, you didn't put money aside for that, or you didn't pay into it, so you're going to owe some taxes. And by the way, we also have some bad news for you this year. You're going to have to pay more taxes. So given that we're heading into tax season, and many of you are probably getting some nasty surprises, remember those retroactive taxes that went into effect, California being one state, in several states last year did raise taxes and make them retroactive to the beginning of the year. So a lot of surprises. And of course, you're probably being told you have another surprise when it comes to 2013. So this being tax season, we're going to devote the show today on our discussion, what to do if you find your taxes going up. Well, you have a chance to fight back.
I'm Kathleen Harris, and coming up later on in the program, we'll be talking a little bit more about that 4% withdrawal rule that Jim and I discussed a few weeks ago. We're going to have on the program a gentleman named Wade Fow, who did some very interesting research about ways to optimize your retirement income from your retirement portfolio assets, and whether or not fixed annuities, laddered bonds, or stocks is a better fit for you. So, Jim, why don't we introduce our listeners into why we decided to go ahead and talk about taxes and tax rates again today?
Well, first of all, we're just about 2 weeks away from the April 15th tax filing deadline. But Kathleen, about a little over a week ago, I was with my accountant, and of course, I was filing my tax return and coming up with my quarterly estimates. And I was asking him, and I said, Kim, I said, you know, what are people doing here that live in California, especially if you're in an upper income bracket, you're a business guy, you know, maybe, you know, he has some athletes here because we have several sports teams here. I said, what are these guys doing? And he says, you know, a lot of them have had sticker shock. A lot of them didn't realize that the tax increase was made retroactive to the beginning of the year. They thought, just like any tax increase, okay, we passed a tax bill, that will affect me next year. So a lot of his clients have not made the extra payments as a result. Because, I mean, we didn't know until, the elections in the first week of November if this was going to pass. It was sort of kind of like 50-50. And so a lot of people have been hit with sticker shock because they've had to come up with extra revenues to make up the difference because of the tax increase. And then on top of that, I said, what are you telling them? You know, we've got the tax increases on the California side, but what are you telling them about the tax increases at the federal level that went into effect? I said, because you're going to have to start, your clients, just like myself, we're going to have to start making estimates or more withholding in paychecks. And he said for some of them, it was really quite a shock because you do have to do that when you're making out your tax return, especially if you're filing, let's say, quarterly estimates or you're going through withholding. Your accountant's going to say, look, you under withheld last year because of the increase in California taxes. Your federal taxes just went up for this year. So you're going to also have to increase your withholding on the federal side. And he said for some of them, it was quite shocking. It was a real eye opener. And so, Kathleen, it's a lot of people going through some real major sticker shock right now.
Well, I think what's interesting, Jim, is if you're a Californian and you were paying taxes in 2011 and you were making a substantial income over $1 million, you're self-employed, if you added up all the taxes that you paid in 2011, federal, Medicare, Social Security, California, all these other things that we pay here in California, you would have been paying it at a tax rate of 58.6%. And then California enacted that additional 3% tax on the wealthy that went into effect, as you mentioned, retroactively, so that all of 2012's income was taxed at a 12.3% rate instead of a 9.3% rate for the highest income earners. So a lot of people went from paying 58.6% and having taxes withheld at 58.6%, essentially 9.3% for California, to all of a sudden having to hold aside 12.3% for California in 2012. And they got caught with this extra 3% that they were supposed to come up with from their reserves to pay the retroactive taxes that were not withheld from their paychecks or their quarterly estimated for 2012. And that's not a small sum of money.
No, I mean, the tax rates went from 58.6 to 61.6. And here's the bad news, folks. And this is probably why Phil Mickelson, who lives in California, garnered a lot of media attention, because for 2013, with the increase in the federal side, Phil is going to be in the 69.1% tax. And I think that's one of the points that he was making. He goes, you know what, do I really want to do another tour when the government basically takes 70% of what I make and I take home 30? And just to sort of put this in perspective, let's take somebody that's self-employed. Maybe he's an athlete, a Padre player, Charger player, golf player, whatever it is. I don't know, Hollywood actor. Anyway, somebody that's successful. And we took $1.25 million of income. Now, in 2011, you would have paid on that $1.25 million $732,500 in taxes. Last year in California, you would have paid $770,000. And 2013, because of the increase in the federal taxes, Social Security, and everything else, you're going to pay $863,750. And then they wonder why consumption is starting to slow. So the point is, taxes have gone up substantially under the Obama administration and also under Jerry Brown's administration here, as they have gone up across the country. There are several states, Illinois being one of them, and other states. It's amazing, Kathleen, that there's starting to be a dichotomy here, and we're in the United States, where you have states, now we have 9 where you don't pay any income taxes, and soon it may be 10 or 11. So there are several states that are going the route and saying, you know what, if we want to increase employment and we want the economy to grow, and if that happens, we get more tax revenues, one of the ways is to have a business-friendly state. And so a lot of states, several right now, are rushing to get rid of their income taxes, while others are raising their income taxes. And I think you're going to see a bifurcated economy. You're going to see certain areas like Texas that have lower unemployment, more robust, let's say, business activity. You take a look at Apple. Apple, which is headquartered in Northern California, they're building 3 new factories here. They're going to spend $100 million. None of those factories will be built in California. They're going to be built mainly in places like Texas, Tennessee, and places where the tax rates are much lower, where employees can live cheaper, pay less taxes, as well as less corporate taxes.
I think to kind of bring this all home, Jen, we were talking about some of the numbers, making it real with some numbers here. So let's just say that your friend Kim has a couple in his office, again, self-employed, making this $1.25 million. They're going to have to come up with another $37,500 additional in withholdings for their increased estimated taxes for 2012. They're going to have to come up with an additional $93,750 for their increased tax rate in 2013. That's a total of $131,250 they're going to have to come up with. That's a 10.5% increase in what they're paying in taxes since 2011. That is a big difference.
And what that means on a monthly basis, their monthly income is going to be reduced by $11,000 a month. And you don't think that's going to affect the economy. What I'd like to do now, since it is, if you are in that kind of bracket, don't give up hope, and especially if you're self-employed, there are things that you can do, and we're going to talk about 4 specific strategies that can be used to reduce taxes. One, an obvious one, is tax-free income. 2 is tax-deferred income. 3 is tax-sheltered income. And 4 is tax-favored income. So those are the 4 basic strategies that you can use if you want to avoid paying this, you know, being put into that 69% tax bracket if you live here in California, or if you live elsewhere in the country. Even if you live in a state like Texas that has no income taxes, you certainly have federal taxes, which can be, and I want to just review for our listeners what the tax rate is, not counting Social Security tax, which is roughly on the, I think it's about the first $116,000 worth of income for 2013. But the top federal tax rate is 39.6. The Medicare Obama tax is 3.8. And then the Pease Amendment tax is 1%. So you're already getting up to 44.4%, even if you live in a tax-free state. So if you do live in a tax-free state, at least you could probably go home with keeping at least over 50% of your income versus the government and the governor. And so the tax rate, even in a tax-free state for 2013, is going to be 44.4%.
So, Jim, what are some ideas that these people can use, that our listeners can use, that are going to help them reduce their amount of taxable income for the year? You mentioned something about tax-free investments. I think you and Rob have discussed these. So why don't we go ahead and talk about some of the tax-free investments people can be investing in with some of their assets?
Well, the obvious one is tax-free municipal bonds. And if you're a California resident, we were just looking at some issues this week for clients where the yields were 3.85 and close to 4%. Now, if you're in that top tax bracket, a 3.85% yield is tax-free yield is equivalent to earning 9.1% pre-tax. A 4% yield is equivalent to earning 9.5%. So even if you look at for California, which is now the highest tax state in the country, those tax-free bonds are equivalent to, you know, I don't know anywhere in the market today, Kathleen, I can earn pre-tax a 9% rate of return. Now, if we look at tax-free bonds nationally, according to the Muni Bond Index, the tax-free yield on 10-year tax-frees is about 2%. That's equivalent to earning pre-tax 4.7. 20-year yields nationally across the country are close to 2.9%. That's closer to like 6.8% tax-free. And 30-year tax-free yields are about 3.2%, which is equivalent to making 7.6. So if you are in that high tax bracket, you may want to be considering tax-free bonds instead of having your income in some taxable investments. So tax-free bonds are probably some of the most obvious ones. If you are a person that needs to have income, you want a source of income to live off, if you're in that tax bracket, and even if you are still working, you have a business and maybe you're 5-10 years away from retirement, you may want to think about putting together a laddered tax-free bond portfolio. It certainly beats paying 70% tax on the interest income that you're earning.
While we're on that topic of the federal income tax you're paying on the interest that you're earning, aren't there other investments I can invest in, Jim, that aren't taxable income that will give me a better return based on tax rate? Sort of more tax advantage type investments?
Yeah, I would say another category is what we call tax sheltered investing. One would be obviously real estate. Now, you don't get any write-offs above the income that you take in if you're an upper-income individual. But certainly, if you put enough down payment on a rental property, whether it's you're buying a residential home, whether you're buying, you know, duplexes, apartments, or even a commercial building, if you're fortunate enough to own one, you can shelter a good portion of your income from the depreciation. So you can have tax-sheltered income. We have several clients who have large real estate holdings that are able to shelter about 40% of their income from federal taxes and state taxes as a result of the tax shelter afforded by real estate. If you are an investor, there are things called master limited partnerships, especially companies that are listed on the stock exchange, pipeline companies, royalty companies, where a good portion of the dividends that are distributed to you are exempt or sheltered from taxation. Sometimes as much as 80% of the dividend can be sheltered from taxation. And when you consider that some of the dividends are in the neighborhood of 5 or 6%, well, if you're earning 5 or 6% and about 80% of that is sheltered from taxation, you're talking about a considerable after-tax yield. So a second form of investing for income is what we call tax-sheltered income. You can do that with individual real estate, or you can do it with things like master limited partnerships. So those are just two ideas on the income front, Kathleen, where you can earn either tax-free income or income that is sheltered from taxes.
So we've talked about interest income from municipal bonds, and we've talked about master limited partnership income, again, with the dividends sometimes being tax advantaged. How do the tax rates on those two types of investments compare, Jim? If I'm just investing in a regular old stock that pays me a dividend, it's not tax sheltered dividend income, what's the difference in taxation on interest income versus dividend income, for example?
This is what I call one of the big undiscovered or misunderstood secrets about investing today under the new tax environment, because there's two things. Number one, if I invest in interest income, let's say I've got interest from a taxable bond, I have money at the bank on a CD, that income is subject to 44.4% federal taxes. And so 44.4%. On the other hand, if I'm getting income from dividends, dividends are subject to only 23.8%. So if you take 44.4 and you take 23.8, you are paying almost 21 percentage points more on your interest income than you are your dividend income. And that was one of the big questions that was going into the end of the year with the fiscal cliff. We didn't know if the tax rates on dividends were going to go up to this 44.4% figure I just mentioned. Instead, they raised the capital gains rate from 15 to 20%, and then, of course, the Obama tax of 3.8. So if you add the two, dividends are taxed, let's just round them off and say interest income can be taxed at almost 45% versus 24% for dividends. So that's the one major difference, and that's a considerable difference if you're trying to invest and put money away for retirement. A second advantage is the fact that dividends pay more return and go up with inflation versus, let's say, government bonds. I mean, if I look at dividends on the Dow Jones Industrial Average today, I could probably get, let me just call up a screen here so we can get some current figures here. But if I look in investing in Dow stocks, I can get a dividend yield of 2.5%. Well, if I look at a similar screen on Treasury yields, I would have to go out 30 years to get something even close to what I could get on a Dow stock. 10-year Treasury yields are only 1.8%, and 2-year Treasury notes are only 0.22. You don't even get a quarter of 1% Treasury yields. So the two big secrets here between taxable interest income and dividends is dividends yield and pay more than what you can get in interest. That's number one. Number two, those dividends, if you pick a good company, are going to increase each year, so you're going to get a pay raise. And number three, those dividends are taxed at a much considerable low level. And Kathleen, if you are under $450,000, if you're a married couple under $400,000, if you're single, you're still at the old Bush tax rates where the capital gains rates are down as low as 10%. So for a vast majority of Americans, the taxes on dividends are probably only about 13.8%. So versus the higher figure I mentioned for upper income individuals, which is 23.8. So even if you're not in that high tax bracket, I'd rather be paying 13.8 versus higher figures when you take a look at what interest is taxed at.
And I think another sort of unintended consequence of the 2013 tax rate changes as well, Jim, is that if you look at the rate at which capital gains are taxed, for example, versus interest income, again, interest income generally taxed at your ordinary income tax rate. Capital gains, maximum rate for long-term capital gains is 23.8%. Again, it's that same difference in cost as you were talking about for dividend interest or dividend income versus interest income. Again, capital gains are taxed at a much cheaper rate than interest income.
You know, another issue, Kathleen, another way of sheltering income, we've talked about a couple here. We've talked about tax-free income, which was, let's say, municipal bonds. We talked about tax-sheltered income, which could be anything from real estate to master limited partnerships. And we talked about tax-favored income, which is, let's say, stocks and dividends. The final area that is often underlooked is tax deferral. And if you are an employee working at a a corporation that offers their 401k, I'm always surprised at the number of individuals that are, number one, not maximizing their, let's say, 401k contributions. And that's one of the first areas you should be contributing to, because you're going to get a tax deduction. You're not going to have to pay taxes on it. That's number one. And number two, while it's accumulating during your working years, it's going to compound tax deferred. So, you know, popular programs by like 401k programs, and many of those 401k programs that most employers offer, usually there's some kind of contribution coming from the employer. Either they're going to match you dollar for dollar, so you get 100% return in your first year on your contribution, 50% match, 25% match, whatever it is, you're going to be accumulating a lot more money, because not only are you putting your own money into savings and getting a tax deduction for it, but many employers are going to match your contribution with a percentage.
Let's not forget the huge tax savings, Jim. If you're able to contribute enough to a 401k or profit sharing plan or 403b or whatever it is that bumps you down to a lower tax bracket, you could save yourself thousands and thousands of dollars in tax payments.
Oh, absolutely. You can cut them down. And if you are running your own business, there are all kinds of tax-deferred pension plans that allow even larger contributions, everything from defined benefits to simple IRAs to SEP IRAs that can allow almost 50 grand a year in contributions. You can do catch-up clauses with even simple 401k programs that allow you to put 23,000. So a husband and wife together can put $46,000. Hire your wife, pay her a salary of $25,000, and put 23,000 of it in a 401k program. It's a something that we often recommend to a lot of our clients who are running their own business. If you would like to put more than that, you can do things like SEP IRAs, which allow even larger contributions, defined benefit plans, which are used where you could really salt away. We had a case study of a gentleman that ran a small tech, high-tech firm. We did it on the show last year, but one of the ways we solved his California problems is we set up a defined benefit pension plan that allowed him to put away $600,000. So basically, we dropped his taxes by almost 40%. Now, it works for him because, number one, he has the income to make the contribution, and number two, he doesn't have a lot of employees. So that isn't necessarily a plan, but you can use a combination plan. You can use a 401k plan combined with the profit sharing, combined with the defined benefit. The point being is you, if you are self-employed, have considerable leeway and options to shelter a major portion of your income. So if you're in your accountant's office this week or listening to the program and you're getting that sticker shock, if you're living in California or elsewhere and your accountant is saying, guess what, you owe this much for California, and by the way, you're going to have to put aside even more for this year because of Obama's taxes. So don't find yourself in that situation the following year in 2014, because they're already talking about additional taxes. Democratic caucus is talking about raising tax rates to 49%. We have the Senate budget that was just passed female senator from Washington, Patty Murray, her budget, which talks about raising tax rates even further. So, guys, they're not done talking about raising taxes. They want to raise taxes even further. The Democratic caucus wants to raise them to close to 50%. The new Democratic budget that was just passed is also going to raise tax rates further. There's another $1 trillion of tax increases coming on top of the $1 trillion of tax increases they put into effect January 1st. So please don't find yourself in that kind of situation where you don't take steps to plan. Remember, the dollars that you save in taxes, those are dollars that are going to be in your pocket, whether you put it in the form of tax-free, tax-sheltered, tax-deferred, or tax-favored. Why pay more tax than you are legally required to do so? The most important thing that you need to do is have some kind of plan for your taxes so you don't get the sticker shock next time you walk into your accountant's office when it comes April 15th, 2014.
A lot of individuals sometimes ask me, Jim, so I'm contributing to my employer's retirement plan, my 401k, my profit sharing plan. Can I still contribute to a traditional IRA? And the answer is generally yes, you can. Whether or not that contribution is tax deductible or not is a whole different story. But yes, if you do have an employer-sponsored plan, you are able to contribute to a traditional IRA. Just may not be all completely tax deductible.
Yeah, if you're under $112,000, it's tax deductible over that. I think they phase it out. And if you are contributing to an IRA and not getting a tax deduction for it, you need to set up a separate IRA to keep track of that, because a portion of that is going to be tax sheltered when you pull it out. And I've seen people make the mistake, they just jumble it all in their IRA. Well, you better make sure, or I recommend you keep a separate account when you're not getting a deduction for it, so you can identify that, oh, on this IRA, I wasn't getting a tax deduction for it. So the contributions I made over the years are going to be tax sheltered when you put it out. Very, very important. And it's a little paperwork, but the easiest way is to segregate your IRA if you're contributing to an IRA with no tax deduction.
We've covered a number of different ideas for people who are high income earners in terms of sheltering their income up front, as well as ways to invest that are more sort of tax savvy in a way. Bottom line, what are some of the investment implications of what we talked about today in terms of, if I'm a high income earner, what should I be looking at in sum in terms of what I should be doing with my money?
Well, I would say if you're a high income earner, depending whether you're self-employed or you have your own business, Kathleen, I'd be taking advantage of all four. Now, some people may not want tax-free income. You know, depending on their age, they might say, you know what, I'm young enough, I want to go for growth. I mean, if you're in your 30s and 40s, unless you're making a gazillion dollars a year, you're probably going to want to use things like tax deferral and also I forgot to mention tax deferred annuities on besides pension plans. So you're going to want to use some kind of tax deferred investing where you can shelter it from either a pension, IRA, tax deferred annuity. You're definitely going to want to look at tax advantage investments, whether it's master limited partnerships, real estate, and then also tax favored investments, dividends versus taxable interest. So I would say all four of those tools, Kathleen, depending on an individual situation, whether they are close to retirement or they're in retirement and they're a high income earner. But I would say making use of all four, and it's just individual preference. Some people need income. Some people want to have income, even though they might need it. They might say, well, you know, I don't need the income, but I'm really helping out one of my kids. I'm putting them through college right now, so I could use the extra income to pay for those college expenses. Or I'm helping out one of my kids that's married. They need some extra money. So there are a number of reasons why you might want to use still all four of those methods of reducing taxes.
I know that this year, my family is in charge of an irrevocable trust we inherited from my dad, and we experienced a little bit of sticker shock ourselves because, again, one of the inadvertent outcomes of the 2013 change in tax law is that irrevocable trust income over $11,950 is going to be taxed at the highest tax rate. And so I think if you're someone out there who's managing money for an irrevocable trust of whatever kind, just keep in mind some of those investment ideas Jim talked about in terms of tax deferred, tax free, tax advantaged income, because you might decide to move your irrevocable trust from investing in taxable bonds to dividend payers, for example. So again, just sort of keep an ear out for those ideas if you're someone who's running an irrevocable trust or responsible for irrevocable trust assets.
And also there's a way to avoid that tax completely. So there's different planning techniques if you're running an irrevocable trust where you don't have to pay those taxes and you can distribute the income and have it taxed at a lower level. So a lot of tools, Kathleen, that people can use. The most important thing, just as we always talk about here on Lifetime Income, have yourself a plan. Whether you're planning for retirement, which would include tax-favored investments, obviously, the less that you have to pay in taxes and the more that you get to keep, the more that you can put away for your own retirement. So having a plan when it comes to your taxes or your retirement is probably the most critical thing. And we're going to move into that topic and talk about retirement income, about one of the myths, or at least one of the philosophies used in retirement planning over the years has been this 4% rule. It's anytime you get a financial plan, somebody shows you pie charts and you get all this boilerplate. Well, embedded in that boilerplate is this 4% rule that as long as you keep your distributions to a 4% level, well, you're going to be okay. Well, we're going to talk with Professor Wade Fow. He is professor of retirement income and the new PhD program for financial and retirement planning at the American College in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. He wrote some topics that were picked up on in the Wall Street Journal article that says, you know what? There are different ways that you can plan for this, and going into bond funds is not one of them. Professor Wade Fow coming up right after this. Joining me on Lifetime Income this week is Professor Wade Fow. He is CFA and Professor of Retirement Income in the new PhD program for Financial and Retirement Planning at the American College in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. Professor, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal written a couple of weeks ago, and it was about the 4% rule in retirement planning. Now, this became the basis for a lot of the retirement planning that has been done in the last couple of decades. The concept is if you withdraw about 4% a year, you could last for about a 30-year lifespan during retirement. And that 4% rule was based on 60% of your portfolio holdings would be held in large cap companies represented like the big Dow stocks and 40% intermediate term bonds. What's wrong with this approach?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the way the 4% rule originally came about, it's kind of an accident that it became called a safe withdrawal rate. When William Bengen was looking at the situation in the 1990s, he was trying to challenge the idea at the time that 7% could be a safe withdrawal rate because the stock market traditionally returned something like 7% after adjusting for inflation. So he said, no, that's not right, that there's an issue of sequence of returns. When you start withdrawing from your portfolio, if the portfolio drops in the early part of your retirement, even if it recovers, you've already withdrawn from your portfolio and you're not going to enjoy that recovery. So he looked at these overlapping periods from history and found that in the worst case scenario, yeah, a portfolio like 60-40 portfolio like you mentioned, in the worst case scenario from history, 4% worked. And then that became called a safe withdrawal rate. It just means that since 1926, over rolling 30-year periods in history, 4% always worked in the United States. But the problem is then thinking that it's always going to work in the future, because in the 20th century United States, the world became a leading superpower. One of the first articles I wrote on this topic was just looking at how the 4% would have worked in most other developed countries. And aside from Canada, the answer was usually in most of the European countries and in Japan and Australia, Great Britain, and so on, there's been a number of historical periods where 4% would not have worked. With bond yields so low today, that's also another challenge about whether the 4% rule will continue to work. So it's just not set in stone that 4% is a safe withdrawal rate.
Professor, does this also have a lot to do with the role of timing? For example, if you were to retire, let's say in the year 1980, you had, two decades, almost 2.5 decades of your retirement years were spent in a bull market with high interest rates. However, if you retired, let's say January 1st of the year 2000, or even worse, January 1st, 2008, you experienced 40% downturns in markets. Doesn't timing also impact this equation?
Right. The timing is absolutely important. Like you were saying, someone who retired around 1980, they could enjoy some of the highest withdrawal rates in history that would be sustainable, even 7 or 8 or even possibly 9%. Whereas I'm really worried about people who've retired, especially in the year 2000. People who retired in the year 2000 should have relatively more wealth than they were expecting because they had that huge market run-up in the late 1990s. But if they're basing their retirement decisions on the 4% rule and then retired as soon as the 4% rule would give them the amount of income they were looking for, they might be in for a shock that it's after a big market run-up, if you then retire and then the market drops in the early part of your retirement. That's going to be the challenge. And historically, 4% always worked, but that's no guarantee or anything of that nature that someone who retired in the year 2000 is going to see 4% working out for them. And so, yeah, that timing is absolutely important. You won't know in advance, but if there's a significant market drop in the early part of retirement, that's the kind of scenario that will do away with, well, that will lead to low sustainable withdrawal rates for your retirement.
Well, proceeding with this idea of that, you want to retire. A lot of people don't even put together retirement budgets. And I think a real key area in retirement planning is putting together a budget of what we call your basic needs. What does it cost to live, you know, pay the bills, utilities, food, gas for the car, et cetera, your medical premiums. And then there's always what I call the bucket list. People have other names for it, wish for list. That's the kind of things like, oh, I'd like to take a trip. I'd like to join a golf course. I'd like to take a hobby. Those are additional expenses. Now, you wrote an article for the Financial Planning Journal that talked about one of the key issues is trying to arrive at a spending rate and a withdrawal rate that is commensurate with that in retirement. And there are five problems that you addressed with this approach, and I wonder if we could talk about them.
Well, one of the ongoing issues that there's challenges and people thinking both ways about whether, as you were describing, the breaking down your spending between your essential expenses and then your, well, they're often called discretionary expenses, or what you were referring to as the bucket list, the things that would really be ideal for you to do if the funds are available. Another school of thought about that says that retirees are just thinking about their lifestyle goal, and that would include some of those trips and things you were mentioning. And if they're not able to achieve that goal, then they'll view their retirement as not having been successful and will consider that a failure. So that's an ongoing issue. So then the way that would work, though, is you tie that 4% rule into, well, how much would you like to be able to spend in retirement and then withdraw that amount? Well, and then the problems with that gets into, there was another study in the 1990s. People, some of your listeners who are nerds about retirement income will know the term the Trinity Study. That was published in the 1990s, and that introduced something called success rates and failure rates, looking over the overlapping periods from history. What's the amount of the frequency of times or the probability historically that the 4% rule would have worked? And there's a lot of problems, I think, with thinking about that particular approach. That's just based on these historical situations, not based on the current market environment today. So even though historically the 4% rule could have a 100% success rate, the bond yields have never been as low as they are. I mean, we're at historic lows in the recent months. So that doesn't mean that there's still this, well, before on the retirement date, you're not necessarily looking at a 100% success rate for 4%. That's one of the big problems, is that kind of approach just looks at these historical averages rather than the current situation. Another problem with that kind of approach is it doesn't consider the magnitude of failure. It just looks at whether or not you run out of money within a given time period, historically, looking at these historical scenarios. So if you're looking at a 30-year retirement, if you miss meeting your lifetime spending goal by $1 in your 30th year of retirement, that's called a failure. And also, if you run out of funds 10 years into retirement and then have nothing for the next 20 years or whatever, then that's considered failure and it's given the same amount of weight. So there needs to be a distinction there. Another approach with that kind of failure rate approach is that it doesn't allow you to think about a broader product allocation, or it, more generally, people have Social Security, they have other sources of income. So if failure in that context is just defined as running out of income from your financial portfolio, but if you have other sources of income, such as Social Security or a pension, or if you've annuitized part of your assets, then the magnitude of the failure, again, in that case, may not be as extreme because you still have this other income to fall back on. People looking at those failure rates tend to define failure as being catastrophic, and that's not necessarily going to be the case for all listeners. I was talking about a lot of things to kind of summarize that. That kind of concept is putting too much weight on U.S. history, not considering what the situation is today. It's not considering when failure happens. It's not considering what else you have in your portfolio. I mean, not your portfolio, but what other sources of income you have, even if your financial portfolio is empty. And so those are the main issues.
You know, it seems, Professor, when the study was done going back to 1926 that took a 30-year time span, if your 30-year time span began in the year 1930, where you had 10 years of the Great Depression, where the Dow lost over, you know, close to 90% of its value. Or you go back to, let's say, the year 2000, where the, you know, the first bear market into 2002, the S&P was down over 40%. You fast forward to 2007 and 2009, the S&P lost another 40%. That's all within one decade. On top of that, the major asset of many retirees has been their home, and we got our first real bear market in housing since the Great Depression. So it seems to me, once again, timing plays such a big factor here because, you know, if you could have retired in 1980 going forward and 20 of your years were spent in, let's say, the 80s, the 90s, and even part of the last decade, you know, you had a much better retirement.
Right. Timing is very important. I have another study. It's called Safe Savings Rates that tries to transfer the whole perspective from looking at how much you withdraw from your portfolio to how much you save during your working years because of that timing issue. Because you have to think about what happens prior to retirement and after retirement. So 1982 is one of the key years where if you retire in 1982, you had the great bull market run after that. You could withdraw 9% and not have a problem if you retired in 1982. But if you retired in 1982, the whole latter part of your career was in the 1970s, early 1980s. You might not have very much money saved in the year 1982. You'd be well behind the plans that if you had started thinking 30 years, so in the early 1950s, you're going to start planning for retirement. Assume your portfolio is going to earn 6 or 7 or 8% a year. In 1982, you're going to be well behind where you thought you were going to be. But at the same time, looking forward from that point, you're going to be able to withdraw a much higher percentage of whatever limited amount of assets you have. And so things tend to smooth out. Whereas in the year 2000, you should be well ahead of schedule for your savings. In the 1990s, your portfolio grew so dramatically that if you were assuming some fixed rate of return, you should have a lot more wealth than you expected. However, you should also be expecting to have a relatively low withdrawal rate in your retirement after that. And that tends to smooth out. So the savings rates that you need to meet a particular spending amount, rather than a withdrawal rate, but a specific spending amount, they tend to smooth out. And historically, rather than having withdrawal rates ranging from historically just 4% through about 9%, these safe savings rates over a 30-year career, looking at a 30-year retirement to replace 50% of your gross income, that ranged from, with like a portfolio that's about 60-40, it was actually 60-40, from about 9% through 17% for savings rates over the career. And that's a lot smoother because withdrawal rates, a very small difference means a big difference in your income, whereas a difference in the savings rate doesn't work out to be as large a percentage of income. But just if you look at something like if you increase your withdrawal rate from 4% to 5%, that means you're spending 25% more income than if you were using the 4%. Whereas if you change the savings rate from 10% to 15%, well, then you're saving 5% more of your income. It's just a smaller magnitude there.
You know, I have found, Professor, and I've read studies that 70% of Americans, when they reach retirement, don't have a retirement plan. And the importance of having a plan where you can actually take a look at your budget and say, this is what it really costs me to live on a daily basis, annual basis, the basic necessities, and then you have the bucket list. I think that's also important that an individual do that, because then I think you can plan your portfolio in a more fitting way to meet those budget goals. Because if you don't know what your basic necessities are, or how much of there is a percentage relationship between basics and, let's say, your wish for list, don't you think by doing that, you can better formulate a portfolio to meet those needs and create a greater degree of certainty when you know what they are?
Yes, absolutely. And what you're describing is a much better way to think about retirement planning that falls outside of the context of the 4% rule. The 4% rule is not really breaking down between your different spending objectives. It's just looking at, well, here's your total, the total spending amount you'd like to have, and then retire when 4% of your savings gives you that spending amount. That's right. That's not a very efficient or effective way to think about retirement. What people should be doing is exactly what you described, and then thinking about matching their assets to the different spending needs. yourself for absolutely essential expenses that you need to make. You should not have that money invested in the stock market. But for things like a wish list, well, that money can put, because you don't have to necessarily meet that spending, you could take more risk with that money in the hopes of earning a higher return and meeting more of those wish list items. But right, what you're describing is absolutely correct, that you need to be making that differentiation and planning, using your investment strategy to match to your spending needs and taking less risky investments for the essential needs. And then if you'd like, take more risky investments for the discretionary wish list type items.
What about the issue, too? You know, when you take the fact that people are living longer, that between a husband and wife or a couple, they could expect between 20, 25 years between the two of them spent in retirement. Now, we also know that when a person retires, let's take a couple that retires at age 65, what they might be doing in the first years of retirement, maybe they're doing more traveling, taking more trips, they're playing more golf, versus, let's say, maybe the last 5 to 10 years of their retirement, where maybe health issues now become important. They're not able to travel, get around as much because of mobility issues. You run into problems like Alzheimer's, dementia, things like that. What about also maintaining a buffer in financial assets? Because we do know later on down the road, we run into health issues. Even early on, you may be running into family issues, divorce, children that need financial help, or some unexpected expense. You own a home in an area where a hurricane, in the path of a hurricane or a tornado, something comes up. I mean, think of Hurricane Sandy in New York, the way that devastated a lot of homeowners. So what about spending patterns in the early years versus the latter years and having a financial buffer?
For that latter point, first of all, yes, that's very important to have a buffer of assets to deal with these sorts of unexpected expenses that you never could have planned for in advance, the needing to help children or some sort of natural disaster or high health expenses and so on. And about the first issue you mentioned, the 4% rule kind of research assumes that people are going to spend a constant inflation-adjusted spending amount. In reality, it seems that people tend to reduce their spending as they age, with the exception of this unknown healthcare or long-term care expenses. But absolutely, in early retirement, those are the go-go years where people may be doing many activities, traveling quite a bit. And then as they get into their 70s and then their 80s, their discretionary spending tends to decline. So then there was other research coming out saying, well, you can plan to spend much more, or you don't have to save as much for retirement because you're not going to be spending the constant inflation-adjusted amount like all the research assumes. When you get in your 70s and 80s, you're going to be spending much less than earlier on. And if you're going to spend less in those later years, you don't need to save as much in the first place. But those kind of studies don't fully incorporate the issue of what's going to happen with healthcare expenses. They tend to compare, well, let's look at, in today, this year, let's compare, well, how much are a group of 65 to 74-year-olds spending? How much are the group of 85-plus spending? How much are the 75 to 84-year-olds spending? And they see from just the current year data that the older groups are spending less than the younger groups. What that's missing is the fact that one of the key issues is healthcare spending or healthcare expenses rise faster than the rate of inflation. So when the current 65 to 75-year-olds get older and become this 75 to 85 or 85-plus, their healthcare expenses may be a lot higher than today's 85-plus and so on. And when you incorporate that kind of issue in, it's not clear what to do about those sorts of assumptions. I wrote a column about that where I just said that, you know, this assuming you're always going to adjust your spending for inflation, that's probably not going to be right. But as a first approximation, it might not be that far off base. And so maybe this traditional research is okay, that your discretionary expenses will decrease as you age, but when you offset that with healthcare, it's not clear what the overall, which one's going to be a bigger effect. But maybe it's okay to assume the constant inflation-adjusted spending.
I want to address two other issues as it relates to, let's say, how you plan your portfolio. One is whether you're going to dip into principal. I've run across clients who said, you know what, everything that I have, it's very important that we leave this to our children because they need it. So they don't want to dip into principal. That's one issue. Another issue that has come about, and that's probably more a reflection of the bear markets and the situation we find ourselves in today as a result of, you know, two bear markets in stocks plus a bear market in housing over the last decade, and that's volatility. People become more nervous today. Anytime there's a crisis, whether it's Cyprus, whether it's Greece, whether it's the fiscal cliff, there's been a little bit more volatility in the market, and you have a lot of people who, as a result of the bear market, maybe don't have the assets they thought they were going to have at retirement. So they're more concerned about volatility. How do we address issues such as, I want to leave my assets to the children versus, well, if the children get what they get, that's what they get? Because that seems, that's a big decision, because that allows you certainly a lot more flexibility if you're planning to meet your budget needs, if you are okay with going and spending some of your principal, and then volatility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the dipping into principal issue, that's kind of a rule of thumb that might possibly lead people into not having the best asset allocation. Just to be clear about the 4% rule, it does assume that you're going to be dipping into principal, because the worst case scenario is defined as where the 4% rule had historically worked. That was that you run out of money after 30 years. So you've been dipping into principal throughout the retirement period. If you want to avoid dipping into principal, you can look at things like just spending the income coming from the portfolio. And that can be an option. You just have to be careful that you're not going to start pushing into too high of yielding. If you're looking for more income and then start moving into more risky bonds that may have defaults and so forth, then you have to just be careful about that, that if you're only going to be spending the income, you're going to be looking at a different kind of portfolio than if you were thinking from the total returns perspective, which allows you to dip into principal, but over the long term may... You dipped into principal, but then the market will go back up. And over the long term, you may have a better chance to leave a legacy if you do dip into principal, but have a more appropriate asset allocation than if you only are going to spend income from your portfolio, but then push your portfolio more towards higher yielding assets that could potentially not be the best fit for you. In terms of volatility, that's scary for people. Historically, when the markets are volatile, when the market goes down, it's always gone back up. But that doesn't mean that's going to happen for any particular person. When you start talking about things like volatility, the two main income tools you have to deal with that are to not to have a mutual fund, a bond mutual fund, because that can go up and down in value. When interest rates go up, probably many of your listeners know this, but not everyone might, but if interest rates go up and you own a bond mutual fund, it can lose value. But what you can do is build a ladder of bonds where you buy the specific bonds that are going to mature on the specific dates with the idea that you're going to then spend the income that year. That allows you to avoid, well, you still could have paper losses if interest rates go up, that if you tried to sell those bonds, they're not going to be worth as much as you paid for them. But if you hold them to their maturity dates, you're not going to lose on the principal. And so one option would be to build a bond ladder like that. And the other option would be to look at different types of annuities, either a single premium immediate annuity where you pay a specific amount and then are guaranteed an income for life from the insurance company that's going to also be supported by the State Guarantee Association. And there's different, either you have a fixed income amount that will not adjust for inflation, or you could have, well, it could go up by a fixed percentage every year. You could pick 1% or 2% or 3% growth, or there's even the single premium immediate annuities that will provide inflation adjustments. That would be one type of annuity option. The other type of annuity option is to get what's either called a GLWB or a GMWB, these guaranteed living withdrawal benefit riders for variable annuities that for a payment, a percentage of assets that's, well, a percentage of the guaranteed benefit base that's paid each year, the insurance company will guarantee that they're going to pay you a given benefit for your entire lifetime, even if the contract value of your assets falls to zero. Those, I think, tend to be rather expensive. There's more effective ways to get those outcomes. But for somebody who's not really going to be planning their own investments and so forth, that could be an option. That one of the ideas behind that, and Professor Moshe Maleski at York University has done research to show, when people have these sorts of guarantees, they feel more comfortable using a more aggressive asset allocation. Because today, someone who's worried about volatility, if they just are going to go into CDs or a mutual fund of bonds and have most of their assets in bonds, the yields are so low that they're going to be eating their principal to survive. And the 4% rule is not going to work for somebody using bond mutual funds or CDs.
I want to stop you there because you mentioned an asset. In the Wall Street Journal article, they cited your work instead of bonds, because most people are going into bond funds, and I was glad to hear you cite the dangers, because we've been pointing out the dangers here on the program, because there are no guarantees and you can lose money versus, as you just talked about, a laddered bond portfolio. But in the Wall Street Journal article, they cited your work using annuities instead of bonds combined with, let's say, blue chip stocks. What did you find in that study that made immediate annuities combined with blue chip stocks a much better alternative?
Right. So that I looked at, well, the immediate annuities and stocks and bonds and also the variable annuities with the guarantee riders. And I looked at 1,001 different combinations of those five assets and looked at how they performed, both in terms of meeting a spending goal, where the spending goal is just to be able to spend a certain amount every year for your entire retirement period. That's one of the objectives. And the other objective is to preserve financial assets to deal with any sort of unexpected expenses or to leave a bequest to your children. And I just looked at how all those 1,001 different combinations performed and found that the most efficient combinations are to use stocks and immediate annuities and combine a portfolio of those. That I wasn't looking at bond ladders, but mutual funds of bonds didn't get you out to the frontier. And also those variable annuities with guarantee riders weren't getting you out to that frontier. That the most effective way to meet the objectives of meeting a spending goal and preserving financial assets was to use stocks combined with immediate annuities. And any allocation of those could be efficient, so it would depend on the client or the individual's perspective of what they're most comfortable with. But some combination of stocks and SPIAs was what I showed to be getting the most efficient outcomes.
And also, I think, would reduce volatility, because if you put a portion in an immediate annuity, obviously that's not going to fluctuate. Whatever amount that's going to be sent to you and your spouse or how you set it up, that never changes. Where even if you have a laddered bond portfolio, if I have a short-term bond, I mean, think of people that had laddered bond portfolios beginning in the year 2000. As those bonds rolled over, and it's why we've seen in bond funds for 5 years running, they've all reduced their payouts, because as they get new money into the bond fund or they have bonds mature, obviously they're going to be investing them at lower interest rates today. And a good example is, you know, 5 years ago, a 2-year treasury note paid 5%. Today, a 2-year treasury note pays less than 0.25%. So it's also, you're not only reducing, let's say, volatility, but you're also having a greater degree of predictability. Professor, wouldn't you say that whether you choose an immediate annuity combined with stocks or, let's say, a laddered bond portfolio combined with stocks, so much of this depends, once again, having a plan where you know what your basic living expenses are, what your wish for or bucket list items are, because then I think you do a much better job of putting together a portfolio that can address and make sure that, for example, you have positively taken care of your basic living expenses and contingencies, and you have room for, you know, if I'm investing in a blue chip stock that raises dividends each year like Coca-Cola, I know that I have a good probability of seeing my income go up from these kind of investments to take care of those future needs. But doesn't it really get down to sitting down, putting together a plan and looking at a budget? I think you can do so much of a better job of putting together a portfolio than just, you know, you see these pie graphs that you see so many times in retirement planning. Oh, you're age 65, you need to put X amount of dollars here, X amount of dollars here. Well, that may be great in terms of a study, but it may not fit the individual.
Right, those kind of the life cycle target date funds just kind of are a default assumption. But you're absolutely right. One of the assumptions in my research is that people know what their budget's going to be because I measure things on how well their budget's being met. And the answers can vary. The lower withdrawal rate somebody needs, the more they can rely on stocks, because from a total returns perspective, they're not withdrawing so much and the stock market, if it goes down, it will eventually come back up, but they're not pulling as much out of the portfolio in the meantime. The higher someone's expenses are relative to their assets, the less volatility they can take in that regard. And then they have to really think about the difference between what are their essential expenses and then what is their lifestyle goal. And the more effort they put into safely meeting their essential expenses, the less upside potential they're going to have to meet their overall goal. And yeah, the answer about what the appropriate allocations are for somebody is really, it depends on their budget. The answers vary by budget, so there is no one answer about what the appropriate allocation is, not even for someone who has the same sort of risk tolerance about if they're comfortable watching the stock market go up and down and they don't lose sleep. Well, that's a separate issue of their, that's risk tolerance. Then there's the risk capacity. What are their spending needs? How would they be able to recover if there's an unexpected surprise either in the market or with their spending and so on? And that's a key part of determining what an appropriate allocation is, which is, it's not addressed by just considering how much. Someone can be very comfortable with the stock market going up and down, not panic, but they may not have the capacity to take risk, and so that's important. And that's important to figuring out what the appropriate allocation is for an individual. So you're absolutely right about that.
Professor, as we close, if you were to give a piece of advice to people considering retirement, either they're retired now or getting close to it, what would that be?
Well, the main thing is to always just monitor where they are with their expenses relative to the value of their portfolio. Their initial retirement spending rate, withdrawal rate from their portfolio, if they had chosen 4%, well, that may evolve over time as things change. And to just keep track of where they are and their age, a big warning sign should be if their withdrawal rate ever goes above 10% of their remaining assets, they should start to expect that they may run out of funds within 10 or 15 years. And if they still have a longer lifespan, they need to do something to either cut back their expenses or to get other sorts of income. But to just stay vigilant, don't think of the 4% rule as a guaranteed safe withdrawal rate. Monitor the portfolio progress and to really just think about making sure to make adjustments so that your retirement can stay on track and not be derailed.
Well, listen, Professor, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. When I read the Wall Street Journal article and read about your study, I wanted to get you on the program because this is an area of specialty for you. You teach retirement planning and financial planning and are a professor of retirement income. So, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Well, that concludes my interview with Dr. Wade Pfau from Bryn Mawr University. It's something so important that the professor talked about there is how you put together a portfolio really depends on what kind of budget, what your expenses are. If you know what those expenses are, your, you know, must-have expenses, your daily living expenses, plus your wish-for list, you can do so much better job of planning your portfolio. So I hope you'll take his advice and also the issues that we discussed earlier on in the program in terms of whether you use an annuity, a laddered bond portfolio. So much of this depends on what kind of plan that you have. So hope that you found this helpful because, you know, there's so many things that go on in retirement planning where you get these pie charts and you get these plans and basically they're just cookie cut boilerplate. You need something that's personal, that really fits your particular needs. We'll have a lot more issues to talk about in the weeks ahead, but we have run out of time. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant rest of the week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.